Chapter 16. A sigh under the flaming blue, a shiver of the sleeping sea, a cool breath, as if a door had been swung upon the frozen spaces of the universe, and with a stir of leaves, with the nod of boughs, with the tremble of slender branches, the sea breeze struck the coast, rushed up the river, swept round the broad reaches, and traveled on in a soft ripple of darkening water, in the whisper of branches, in the rustle of leaves of the awakened forests. It fanned in Lakamba's camp on the dull red of expiring embers into a pale brilliance, and, under its touch, the slender, upright spirals of smoke that rose from every glowing heap swayed, wavered, and eddying down filled the twilight of clustered shade trees with the aromatic scent of the burning wood. The men who had been dozing in the shade during the hot hours of the afternoon woke up, and the silence of the big courtyard was broken by the hesitating murmur of yet sleepy voices, by coughs and yawns, with now and then a burst of laughter, a loud hail, a name or a joke sent out in a soft drawl. Small groups squatted round the little fires, and the monotonous undertone of talk filled the enclosure, the talk of barbarians, persistent, steady, repeating itself in the soft syllables, in musical tones of the never-ending discourses of those men of the forests and the sea, who can talk most of the day and all the night, who never exhaust a subject, never seem able to thresh a matter out, to whom that talk is poetry and painting and music, all art, all history, their only accomplishment, their only superiority, their only amusement. The talk of campfires, which speaks of bravery and cunning, of strange events, and of far countries, of the news of yesterday and the news of tomorrow. The talk about the dead and the living, about those who fought, and those who loved. Lakamba came out on the platform before his own house and sat down perspiring, half asleep, and sulky in a wooden armchair under the shade of the overhanging eaves. Through the darkness of the doorway he could hear the soft warbling of his womenkind, busy round the looms, where they were weaving the checkered pattern of his gala sarongs. Right and left of him on the flexible bamboo floor those of his followers to whom their distinguished birth, long devotion, or faithful service had given the privilege of using the chief's house, were sleeping on mats, or just sat up rubbing their eyes. While the more wakeful had mustered enough energy to draw a chessboard with red clay on the fine mat, and were now meditating silently over their moves. Above the prostrate forms of the players, who lay face downward supported on elbow, the soles of their feet waving irresolutely about, in the absorbed meditation of the game, there towered here and there the straight figure of an attentive spectator looking down with dispassionate but profound interest. On the edge of the platform a row of high-heeled leather sandals stood ranged carefully in a level line, and against the rough wooden rail leaned the slender shafts of the spears belonging to these gentlemen, the broad blades of dulled steel looking very black in the reddening light of approaching sunset. A boy of about 12, the personal attendant of Lakamba, squatted at his master's feet, and held up towards him a silver surai box. Slowly Lakamba took the box, opened it, and tearing off a piece of green leaf deposited in it a pinch of lime, a morsel of gamier, a small bit of erica nut, and wrapped up the whole with a dexterous twist. He paused, morsel in hand, seemed to miss something, turned his head from side to side, slowly, like a man with a stiff neck, and ejaculated in an ill-humored bass, "Babalatchi." The players glanced up quickly, and looked down again directly. Those men who were standing stirred uneasily, as if prodded by the sound of the chief's voice. The one nearest to Lakamba repeated the call, after a while, over the rail into the courtyard. There was a movement of upturned faces below by the fires, and the cry trailed over the enclosure in sing-song tones. The thumping of wooden pestles husking the evening rice stopped for a moment, and Babalatchi's name rang afresh shrilly on women's lips in various keys. A voice far off shouted something, another, nearer, repeated it. There was a short hubbub which died out with extreme suddenness. The first crier turned to Lakamba, saying indolently, "He is with the blind Omer." Lakamba's lips moved inaudibly. The man who had just spoken was again deeply absorbed in the game going on at his feet, and the chief, as if he had forgotten all about it already, sat with a stolid face amongst his silent followers, leaning back squarely in his chair, his hands on the arms of his seat, his knees apart, his big bloodshot eyes blinking solemnly, as if dazzled by the noble vacuity of his thoughts. Babalichai had gone to see old Omer late in the afternoon. The delicate manipulation of the ancient pirate's susceptibilities, the skillful management of Asa's violent impulses engrossed him to the exclusion of every other business, interfered with his regular attendance upon his chief and protector, even disturbed his sleep for the last 3 nights. That day when he left his own bamboo hut, which stood amongst others in Lakamba's campong, his heart was heavy with anxiety and with doubt as to the success of his intrigue. He walked slowly, with his usual air of detachment from his surroundings, as if unaware that many sleepy eyes watched from all parts of the courtyard his progress towards a small gate at its upper end. That gate gave access to a separate enclosure in which a rather large house, built of planks, had been prepared by Lakamba's orders for the reception of Omer and Asa. It was a superior kind of habitation which Lakamba intended for the dwelling of his chief advisor, whose abilities were worth that honor, he thought. But after the consultation in the deserted clearing, when Babalichai had disclosed his plan, they both had agreed that the new house should be used at first to shelter Omer and Asa, after they had been persuaded to leave the Raja's place, or had been kidnapped from there as the case might be. Babalichai did not mind in the least the putting off of his own occupation of the House of Honor, because it had many advantages for the quiet working out of his plans. It had a certain seclusion, having an enclosure of its own, and that enclosure communicated also with Lakamba's private courtyard at the back of his residence, a place set apart for the female household of the chief. The only communication with the river was through the great front courtyard, always full of armed men and watchful eyes. Behind the whole group of buildings there stretched the level ground of rice clearings, which in their turn were closed in by the wall of untouched forests with undergrowth so thick and tangled that nothing but a bullet, and that fired at pretty close range, could penetrate any distance there. Babalichai slipped quietly through the little gate and, closing it, tied up carefully the rattan fastenings. Before the house there was a square space of ground, beaten hard into the level smoothness of asphalt. A big buttress tree, a giant left there on purpose during the process of clearing the land, roofed in the clear space with a high canopy of gnarled boughs and thick, somber leaves. To the right and some small distance away from the large house, a little hut of reeds, covered with mats, had been put up for the special convenience of Omer, who, being blind and infirm, had some difficulty in ascending the steep plankway that led to the more substantial dwelling, which was built on low posts and had an uncovered veranda. Close by the trunk of the tree, and facing the doorway of the hut, the household fire glowed in a small handful of embers in the midst of a large circle of white ashes. An old woman, some humble relation of one of Lakamba's wives, who had been ordered to attend on Asa, was squatting over the fire, and lifted up her bleared eyes to gaze at Babalichai in an uninterested manner, as he advanced rapidly across the courtyard. Babalichai took in the courtyard with a keen glance of his solitary eye, and without looking down at the old woman, muttered a question. Silently, the woman stretched a tremulous and emaciated arm towards the hut. Babalichai made a few steps towards the doorway, but stopped outside in the sunlight. Oh! To an Omer B, sir. It is I, Babalichai. Within the hut there was a feeble groan, a fit of coughing, and an indistinct murmur in the broken tones of a vague plaint. Encouraged evidently by those signs of dismal life within, Babalichai entered the hut, and after some time came out, leading with rigid carefulness the blind Omer, who followed with both his hands on his guide's shoulders. There was a rude seat under the tree, and there Babalichai led his old chief, who sat down with a sigh of relief, and leaned wearily against the rugged trunk. The rays of the setting sun, darting under the spreading branches, rested on the white-robed figure sitting with head thrown back in stiff dignity, on the thin hands moving uneasily, and on the stolid face with its eyelids dropped over the destroyed eyeballs. A face set into the immobility of a plaster cast yellowed by age. Is the sun near its setting? Asked Homer, in a dull voice. Very near, answered Babalatchi. Where am I? Why have I been taken away from the place which I knew where I, blind, could move without fear? It is like black night to those who see. And the sun is near its setting and I have not heard the sound of her footsteps since the morning. Twice a strange hand has given me my food today. Why? Where is she? She is near, said Babalatchi. And he? Went on Homer, with sudden eagerness, and a drop in his voice. Here is he? Not here. Not here. He repeated, turning his head from side to side, as if in deliberate attempt to see. No. He is not here now, said Babalatchi, soothingly. Then, after a pause, he added very low, but he shall soon return. Return? O crafty one! Will he return? I have cursed him 3 times, exclaimed Homer, with weak violence. He is no doubt accursed, assented Babalatchi, in a conciliating manner, and yet he will be here before very long, I know. You are crafty and faithless. I have made you great. You were dirt under my feet less than dirt, said Homer, with tremulous energy. I have fought by your side many times, said Babalatchi, calmly. Why did he come? Went on Homer. Did you send him? Why did he come to defile the air I breathe, to mock at my fate, to poison her mind and steal her body? As he has grown hard of heart to me. Hard and merciless and stealthy like rocks that tear a ship's life out under the smooth sea. He drew a long breath, struggled with his anger, then broke down suddenly. Have been hungry, he continued, in a whimpering tone, then I have been very hungry, and cold and neglected, and nobody near me. As he has often forgotten me, and my sons are dead, and that man is an infidel and a dog. Why did he come? Did you show him the way? He found the way himself, O leader of the brave, said Babalatchi, sadly. Only saw a way for their destruction and our own greatness. And if I saw right, then you shall never suffer from hunger anymore. There shall be peace for us, and glory and riches. And I shall die tomorrow, murmured Homer, bitterly. Who knows? Those things have been written since the beginning of the world, whispered Babalatchi, thoughtfully. Do not let him come back, exclaimed Homer. Neither can he escape his fate, went on Babalatchi. He shall come back, and the power of men we always hated, you and I, shall crumble into dust in our hand. Then he added with enthusiasm, they shall fight amongst themselves and perish both. And you shall see all this, while, I doubt, true, murmured Babalatchi, regretfully. Oh, you life is darkness. No. Flame! Exclaimed the old Arab, half rising, then falling back in his seat. He flame of that last day. I see it, yet the last thing I saw. And I hear the noise of the rent earth when they all died. And I live to be the plaything of a crafty one, he added, with inconsequential peevishness. You are my master still, said Babalatchi, humbly. Why, you are very wise, and in your wisdom you shall speak to Said Abdullah, when he comes here you shall speak to him as I advised, I, your servant, the man who fought at your right hand for many years. I have heard by a messenger, that the Said Abdullah is coming tonight, perhaps late, for those things must be done secretly, lest the white man, the trader up the river, should know of them. But he will be here. There has been a surat delivered to Lakamba. In it, Said Abdullah says he will leave his ship, which is anchored outside the river, at the hour of noon today. He will be here before daylight if Allah wills. He spoke with his eye fixed on the ground, and did not become aware of Asa's presence till he lifted his head when he ceased speaking. As he had approached so quietly that even Homer did not hear her footsteps, and she stood now looking at them with troubled eyes and parted lips, as if she was going to speak. But at Babalatchi's entreating gesture she remained silent. Omer sat absorbed in thought. Awa! Even so, he said at last, in a weak voice, I am to speak your wisdom, O Babalatchi. Tell him to trust the white man. I do not understand. I am old, and blind and weak. I do not understand. I am very cold, he continued, in a lower tone, moving his shoulders uneasily. He ceased, then went on rambling in a faint whisper. They are the sons of witches, and their father is Satan the Stoned. Sons of witches. Sons of witches. After a short silence he asked suddenly, in a firmer voice, how many white men are there here, O crafty one? There are two here. Two white men to fight one another, answered Babalatchi, with alacrity. And how many will be left then? How many? Tell me, you who are wise. The downfall of an enemy is the consolation of the unfortunate, said Babalatchi, sententiously. They are on every sea. Only the wisdom of the Most High knows their number, but you shall know that some of them suffer. Tell me, Babalatchi, will they die? Will they both die? Asked Omer, in sudden agitation. Asa made a movement. Babalatchi held up a warning hand. They shall, surely, die, he said steadily, looking at the girl with unflinching eye. Awa! But die soon, so that I can pass my hand over their faces, when Allah has made them stiff. If such is their fate and yours, answered Babalatchi, without hesitation. Odd is great. A violent fit of coughing doubled Omer up, and he rocked himself to and fro, wheezing and moaning in turns, while Babalatchi and the girl looked at him in silence. Then he leaned back against the tree, exhausted. I am alone, he wailed feebly, groping vaguely about. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.